A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel and Hannah are planning a trip, and Hannah, who's an architect, keeps telling him Athens feels like Jerusalem. Not the postcard version, the real one. The slightly run-down, lived-in, cats, everywhere version. And Daniel's never been, so he wants to know what that actually means. Here's what he wrote. I live in one of the oldest, continuously inhabited cities in the world, Jerusalem. Not too far away in Europe are two other cities that are the stuff of ancient civilization, Rome and, a bit closer to here, Athens. I'd love to chat today about Athens, a city which I've never visited but may have occasion to soon for a day or so. My wife, who's an architect and bought me a fantastic leather bag from Athens, speaks fondly of the city, but not in the way you might expect. She tells me that Jerusalem has a certain understated and slightly countercultural feel, that it's a bit run down and actually feels surprisingly similar. Jerusalem, as some people might know, has a strangely large population of feral cats who are harmless but roam throughout the city. My wife tells me Athens also has some furry denizens. For those who haven't been, I want to get a short taste of what the history books tell you, but what daily life in Greece and Athens is actually like. What are some things you might recommend to soak up the local culture and experience the city as it really is? So the question is, what does daily life in Athens actually feel like beyond the marble and the myths? Let's start there.
The Jerusalem comparison is the key to the whole thing. Most people approach Athens like it's a museum with traffic. You check off the Acropolis, you maybe do the Archaeological Museum, and then you're done. But Hannah's observation about it feeling like Jerusalem, that's someone who actually paid attention to the texture of a place. Both cities are palimpsests. You've got 3,000 plus years of continuous habitation, and nobody ever quite cleared the slate before building the next layer. So you end up with a city where the ancient and the everyday aren't separated by a velvet rope. They're just a stalactite.
A palimpsest. That's the word you're going with.
It's the right word. A manuscript where the old text was scraped off and new text written over it, but you can still see the earlier layers bleeding through. Athens is exactly that. You walk down a street in Koukaki, and there's a neoclassical building from the 1800s with a taverna on the ground floor that's been there for 60 years, and behind it you can see a fragment of a Byzantine church, and underneath all of that there's probably a classical era cistern that the building's foundation is sitting on. Nobody planned this. It just accumulated.
Which is also Jerusalem in a sentence. The accumulation, not the planning.
Right. And that's what Hannah meant by rundown. It's not neglect. Well, sometimes it's neglect, but it's mostly that these cities resist the impulse to sand everything smooth for tourists. Jerusalem's got stone walls with three different eras of masonry visible in a single stretch. Athens has neoclassical facades from the 1880s that are peeling in exactly the way that tells you someone still lives on the third floor and hangs their laundry out the window.
The laundry is the tell. A city that's been museumified doesn't have laundry.
And Athens has laundry everywhere. The first thing you notice when you walk through neighborhoods like Exarchia or Kypsele is that people actually live there. The buildings are 6 or 7 stories, mostly from the post-war period. These polykatoikis, apartment blocks, built in a rush during the urbanization wave of the 50s and 60s. They're not pretty. Concrete, functional, balconies crammed with potted basil and drying racks. But they're real in a way that the whitewashed, cycladic fantasy version of Greece is not.
So, the rundown aesthetic is partly just the absence of a tourism board's budget.
And partly a deliberate resistance. Exarchia is the neighborhood you have to understand to get Athens. Since the 1970s, it's been the center of anarchist and leftist political activity. The walls are covered in murals and graffiti. Not the spray paint tag kind, but elaborate political art, memorials to killed activists, slogans about gentrification and police violence. There's a famous mural of the poet Yanis Ritsos. There's one of the activists, Alexandros Grigoropoulos, whose killing by police in 2008 sparked massive riots. These aren't decorations. They're a living political conversation on the walls.
And a tourist walks through this and thinks, what exactly?
Depends on the tourist. Some find it intimidating. Some find it thrilling. But the point is, it's not curated for you. That's the difference between Exarchia and Plaka. Plaka is the neighborhood at the foot of the Acropolis. It's beautiful, neoclassical, pedestrian streets, tavernas with menus in 6 languages. It's also, honestly, a bit of a theme park. Exarchia is 3 kilometers away, and it might as well be a different city. Independent bookshops, anarchist social centers, tiny cafes where people argue about politics for 4 hours over a single Freddo espresso.
Freddo espresso. You've been waiting to say that.
I have, and I'll come back to coffee culture because it's central to understanding daily life in Athens. But first, the sensory experience. Because the texture of a city isn't just visual, it's smell and sound. Athens in the summer smells like jasmine and diesel simultaneously. The jasmine climbs up the sides of buildings, and the diesel is from the endless traffic. And the sound, if you're in a residential neighborhood in the evening, you'll hear bouzouki music drifting out of someone's apartment, mixed with the hum of air conditioners and someone's grandmother yelling from a balcony. The grandmother on the balcony is a universal Mediterranean constant. Jerusalem has the same thing. You know this. We live it.
I do know this. The balcony grandmother is a cross-cultural institution.
And the rhythm of the day in Athens is completely different from what a Northern European or American visitor expects. The city wakes up late. Coffee culture isn't a quick caffeine hit. It's a social ritual that can last 2 hours. The traditional caffeneo is still around. These old-school coffee houses with wooden chairs and elderly men playing backgammon, but the modern version is the cafe where everyone under 40 sits with a Freddo cappuccino and a phone, and they're not in a hurry. Lunch is at 2 or 3 in the afternoon, it's a full meal, and then things slow down. Shops close, people nap or hide from the heat. And then around 7 or 8 in the evening, the whole city comes back to life.
The Volta.
The Volta. The evening stroll. It's not exercise, it's not window shopping, it's a social ritual. Families, couples, groups of friends, they all come out and walk. The pedestrian streets like Ermau and the squares in Kolonaki fill up. You walk, you stop for a gelato or a souvlaki, you see people you know, you keep walking. It's not about getting somewhere, it's about being seen and being part of the city.
So if you're visiting for one day, you should time your day around this rhythm, not fight it.
And we'll get to the practical recommendations. But first, let me land the Jerusalem comparison, because I think it's the most useful lens. In both cities, the monuments are almost beside the point. The Western Wall, the Acropolis, they're there, they're important, but the actual experience of the city is in the streets between them, the market, the coffee, the cats.
The cats. Daniel mentioned them, and Hannah apparently flagged them specifically. Tell me about the cats of Athens.
They're everywhere. Tens of thousands of them. Nobody knows the exact number, but estimates run from 30,000 to well over 100,000 in the metropolitan area. And they're not exactly strays in the way an American or Northern European would understand it. They're community cats. They belong to a particular street, a particular square, a particular taverna. The locals feed them. There are volunteer groups. Athens Stray Cats is one of the bigger ones that do trap-neuter return programs and organize feeding routes.
So they're not pests. They're residents.
They're unofficial residents with a very long pedigree. Most of these cats are descended from cats that arrived on ships over centuries of Mediterranean trade. Athens has been a port city for 3,500 years, and cats have been on ships for almost as long, keeping the rats down. They disembarked, they stayed, they multiplied. The cats you see sunning themselves on the steps of a Byzantine church in Plaka are the descendants of cats that might have arrived on a Venetian galley in the 1400s. They're as much a part of the city's history as the Parthenon.
That's a claim. The Parthenon is marble and columns and the symbolic weight of Western civilization. The cats are cats.
And which one do you actually interact with when you're in Athens? Nobody touches the Parthenon. It's roped off, it's crowded, you look at it for 20 minutes, and you leave. But the cats. You sit down at a taverna, and a cat curls up under your chair. You walk through the National Garden, and there are cats sleeping on benches. They're the living, breathing, purring connection to the city's daily life. And they tell you something about the Athenian attitude toward the world. a tolerance for the unplanned, the communal, the slightly wild.
Jerusalem has the same thing. The cats here are everywhere. And the attitude is similar. They're not exactly owned, but they're cared for. Someone puts out food. Someone calls a vet if one's injured.
And in both cities, the cats are a kind of litmus test. If you're the kind of visitor who's annoyed by stray cats, who sees them as a problem to be solved, you're probably going to miss what's special about Athens. If you can sit at a cafe and appreciate the cat that's decided to occupy the chair next to you, you're already halfway to understanding the city.
That's surprisingly profound for a cat metaphor.
Thank you. I've been workshopping it.
I can tell. So, let's get practical. Daniel's got maybe a day. What does he actually do?
First decision. Do you do the Acropolis or not? Here's my honest answer. If you've never been, it's hard to skip. But the way most people do it, arriving at 10 in the morning with 1,000 other people, shuffling up the hill in the heat, taking the same photo everyone takes, that's miserable. If you're going to do it, go at sunrise. The gates open at 8, and if you're there right when they open, you get maybe 45 minutes before the crowds really descend. The light is beautiful, the temperature is bearable, and you can actually have a moment with the place.
And then you get out and never look back.
And then you get out and spend the rest of the day living in the actual city. Here's my itinerary. Morning, Acropolis at 8, done by 9:30. Then walk down through Anaphiotica. That's the tiny neighborhood on the north slope of the Acropolis, built by stonemasons from the island of Anaphi in the 1800s. It looks like a Cycladic village, whitewashed houses, and narrow alleys completely unexpected in the middle of Athens. Then head to the Varvakio Central Market.
Tell me about the market.
It's been operating since 1886. It's a massive iron and glass structure on Athena Street, and it's the beating heart of Athenian food culture. The meat hall is intense. Whole carcasses hanging, butchers shouting, the smell of fresh blood and sawdust. The fish hall is a riot of silver and red, everything gleaming on ice. And then there are the spice vendors, the olive sellers, the cheesemongers. It's loud, it's chaotic, it's not remotely sanitized for tourists. And it's where you understand that Athens is a city that eats seriously.
So Daniel goes to the market. Then what?
He buys a kouluri. That's the sesame bread ring that street vendors sell everywhere. And he walks. And this is the most important advice I can give. Pick one neighborhood and stay there. Don't try to cover the whole city. You can't. Athens is 3.1 million people spread across a sprawling metropolitan area. Trying to do Athens in a day is like trying to do London in a day. Pick a neighborhood and go deep.
Which neighborhood?
It depends on what you want. Exarchia, if you want the countercultural energy, the murals, the bookshops, the slightly grungy student vibe. Koukaki, if you want something more residential and food-focused. It's been called one of the world's coolest neighborhoods by various travel publications, which means it's gentrifying fast, but it still has a genuine local feel. Siri, if you want the nightlife and the street art and the live music. For a single day, I'd probably say start in Koukaki. Walk through to the area around the Acropolis Museum. Not the museum itself, but the pedestrian streets around it, and then drift towards Siri for the evening.
The evening is the Volta.
The evening is the Volta. You walk. You stop for a glass of Sapporo or Ouzo. You eat souvlaki from a street stand, not a sit-down restaurant. The stand where the guy is turning the meat on a vertical spit and wrapping it in pita with tomatoes and onions and tzatziki. You find a taverna with live music, which in Siri isn't hard. And you sit there for 2 hours, eating grilled octopus and horiatiki. That's Greek salad, but never call it Greek salad in Greece. It's horiatiki, village salad. And you watch the city go by.
You're making me hungry.
Good. That's the point. Athens is a city you experience through your senses, not through a checklist. The food, the smells, the sounds, the cats, the laundry on the balconies, the graffiti on the walls. If you come back with a photo of the Parthenon and nothing else, you missed it.
The alternative to the Acropolis? If Daniel decides he doesn't want to fight the crowds at all.
Philopappus Hill. It's a 15-minute walk from the Acropolis, and almost nobody goes there. It's a wooded hill with a monument to a Roman-era prince at the top, and the view is spectacular. You see the Acropolis, the city, the sea. Locals go there to walk their dogs, to have a picnic, to watch the sunset. It's quiet, it's free, and it gives you the same visual payoff as the Acropolis without the ticket line.
You see the Acropolis without being on the Acropolis.
In some ways, that's the better view. The Parthenon is more impressive from a distance when you can see its silhouette against the sky. Up close, it's covered in scaffolding half the time. There's been a restoration project running since the 1980s.
Wait, really? 40 years of scaffolding?
The restoration is incredibly painstaking. They're replacing iron clamps from earlier restorations with titanium, recarving damaged marble, repositioning blocks that were put back wrong in the 1930s. It's a masterpiece of archaeological conservation. But yes, parts of the Parthenon have been under scaffolding for most of our lives.
There's a metaphor here about the city itself. The ancient glory is always a bit of a construction site.
That's the thing Hannah was getting at with Rundown. Athens doesn't hide its construction sites. It doesn't hide its peeling paint or its stray cats or its political arguments. Jerusalem doesn't either. Both cities are too old, too layered, too stubborn to be polished into something they're not. And the visitors who get the most out of them are the ones who don't need everything to be postcard perfect.
Let's learn the practical takeaways. Daniel's got a day. He's going to Athens for the first time. What are the three or four things he should actually do?
1. Pick one major thing in the early morning. Acropolis at 8, or Philopappus Hill, or the Central Market. Do that one thing, and then stop doing things. 2. Spend the rest of the day in one neighborhood. Walk slowly. Sit in a cafe for an hour. Eat lunch at a place where the menu is only in Greek and you have to point at what you want. 3. Embrace the cats. If a cat sits next to you, you've been accepted. 4. Do the Volta in the evening. Walk without a destination. Eat street food. Listen for music. Let the city set the pace.
The thing not to do?
Don't try to see everything. Don't spend your day in transit between sites. Don't eat in a restaurant with a guy outside trying to wave you in. And don't expect Athens to be Santorini. It's not a whitewashed postcard. It's a loud, messy, 3,000-year-old city that's still very much alive.
The cats are a metaphor.
The cats are a metaphor. If you can appreciate the stray cats, you can appreciate Athens. They're a sign of a city that tolerates the unplanned, the communal, and the wild. They don't perform for you, they just are. And the city is the same way.
Before we wrap, there's a bigger question lurking here. What does it mean for a city to be authentic in the age of mass tourism? Because the version of Athens we've been describing, the rundown, countercultural, cat-filled Athens, that's under pressure. Koukaki gentrifying. Exarchia facing development pressure. The polykatoikis being converted into Airbnbs.
It's the tension every great city faces. The very qualities that make a place interesting to visitors. The authenticity, the grit, the sense that it's a real living city and not a theme park. Those qualities get eroded by the visitors they attract. You see it in Lisbon, you see it in Mexico City, you see it in parts of Jerusalem. The neighborhood that was undiscovered 5 years ago now has a cereal cafe and a boutique hotel.
A cereal cafe. That's the marker of the end times.
It really is, and Athens is at an inflection point. The financial crisis of the 2010s hollowed out a lot of neighborhoods, and now investment is flowing back in, but it's not always flowing in ways that benefit the people who stayed through the hard years. So the question is whether Athens can develop without losing the texture that makes it Athens. I don't know the answer. I'm not sure anyone does.
It's the same question Jerusalem is grappling with, just with different specifics. How do you preserve the lived-in quality of a place when the economic incentives all push toward polish and monetization?
Part of the answer might be that these cities are stubborn. 3,000 years of history gives a place a certain resistance to being smoothed over. The cats will still be there. The grandmothers will still be on the balconies. The graffiti will still be on the walls. You can gentrify a neighborhood, but you can't gentrify an entire civilization.
That's either deeply optimistic or deeply naive. I'm not sure which.
Probably both. That's the show, really.
Before we close, the cutting room floor. You mentioned the Varvakios market, but you didn't mention what happens around the back of it. The tripe soup.
Oh, the patzas. There are these restaurants around the market that open at 3 a.m, serving tripe soup to the butchers and fishmongers finishing their shifts and to people stumbling out of clubs. It's a completely different Athens. The city after dark, the city of workers and night owls. And the patzas is supposedly a hangover cure. I can't vouch for that personally.
A detail for Daniel's next trip, maybe. When he has more than a day.
When he has more than a day and a stronger stomach.
All right. One open question to leave people with. What do the stray animals in your city say about it? Athens and Jerusalem both have cats that are tolerated, fed, cared for collectively. That's not universal. Some cities round them up. Some cities ignore them. What's the relationship between a city's treatment of its unofficial animal residents and its treatment of everything else? Its history, its messiness, its people.
That's a good place to land. We'd love to hear from listeners who've been to Athens or Jerusalem. What did you notice? What did the guidebooks miss? Email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.